Mr. Cheeseman, Reel 9. We're talking about the actual training in this period of time when you were working on a tank engine. I think you said they were the medium tank.
Yes, the Vickers medium tank. You'll appreciate the fact that the British Army in those days, the tanks were out of fashion, really, in the 20s and almost in the 30s as well. That we were equipped with two types of tank generally. The medium tank, 12 to 14 tons, and the light tank, about 5 tons. The light tank I didn't get into the guts of a light tank until I went to my service battalion, so more about that later. I'll stick to this medium tank. Now, you'll appreciate the fact here that I've been saying that in the mornings we did this and on top of the moors we have to do things, and nothing about tanks at all other than how to drive it. Well, that of course came in our service battalion. And not only that, it would have been too much for us to absorb, i.e. there was the basic vehicle, the lorry. And with a little bit of stretching of the imagination, what happens with the lorry happens with the tank. We know that you can argue, say, well, the lorry doesn't have trucks and things like that. Yes, that's fair enough. But it has an engine, it has a transmission, it has a means of propelling it along, and that's what a tank has. Mechanically speaking, we know, I'm not talking about the armament. So, in other words, we were taught the easy thing first, before we went on to the hard thing. Very good, it's a good system. So, as I say, we came... Anyway, as I was saying before there about this oil system, it's very difficult, I'm finding it very difficult now, to explain how the circulation of the oil, and especially with the tank engine, just explain it by words. How much better if I had a picture, if it was TV, if I had a picture, and that's exactly what we had. There on the, in one hut there, classrooms were in huts, we had a huge board with the painting of a sectionalised tank engine, and its oil container, and everything like that, and its pumps and all that technology. And connecting each item was a glass tube, actual glass tube. And in this glass tube was red liquid interspersed with bubbles. They had a special bubble pump to do this. When they started off, you could see that the red blank, as it were, moving from the canister into the pressure pump, from the pressure pump into the main oil gallery, from the main oil galleries into the main bearings, from the main bearings to the connecting rods and up to the small ends, and then the sprays onto the... it was all there, and then it was dripping down into the sink, and then it was picked up by the suction pump and put back into the canister. And it was all there, a television set, as it were, in those days, only of course it was mechanical. I mean, it was brilliant. And we had umpteen things like that. You know, I can sort of bring to mind other things, but I can certainly, when we come to the next course, I can tell you something very similar to that.
But this was basic training on a tank engine of the day.
Yes. We had the engines that I was trained on in those 17 weeks, I think is that. And those 17 weeks of D&M was the Morris commercial lorry engine, the Rolls-Royce armoured car engine, the Humber car engine, the oh dear me, the Leyland engine, then the Meadows engine. That was the only bit of like tank that we had with the engine. The Rolls Royce of the lead tank engine, and then of course was the big fella, the medium tank engine, the Vickers Armstrong V8. I mentioned Rolls Royce lead tank engine. Two individuals back as far back as 1922, a Sir Carden Lloyd and a Vivian, Sir Charles Carden and Vivian Lloyd, as a private enterprise, hired a disused laundry, designed and built the prototype light tank, and offered it to the War Office, and they accepted it. Yes, their very first tank, light tank, was a Meadows engine. But quickly, that's Mark 1. Mark 2, Mark 3, Mark 4 light tank were Rolls Royce engines. Then the Mark 5 came back to the Meadows engines. That's where the Rolls Royce came in, besides the Rolls Royce armoured car. Oh, yes, the Crossley armoured car. If you give me about half an hour, I'll give you the whole lot, but nevertheless. It was very extensive. The Lanchester, that's right, because I think pretty well everyone knows about the poppet valve of an internal combustion engine, the mushroom type valve, it opens and shuts and things like that. The Lanchester didn't have poppet valves, it had slide valves, i.e., if you can imagine a thin cylinder of metal with the piston inside, but itself finished to a high degree of accuracy on the outside, this cylinder, and the whole of that is put inside a second cylinder, and so we've got the piston and two cylinders all sliding against each other, and the whole of that put into the cylinder block of an engine. Now, those two cylinders, by means of eccentrics, were allowed to slide up and down against each other. And then the tops were ports, openings. Now, if you open them, if you slide them up and down, they open and shut. And that's the open and shut for the exhaust and the, the smooth, very smooth engine. And I should think a very, very expensive engine, too, to build. But this was all, I'm now talking, because I've never seen them since, I'm now talking from stuff that I was taught 62 years ago, and it's there. So that shows you just how thorough the job they did.
Did you have a favourite engine to work on? I mean, you've had a very wide range of engines.
All mechanical things were favourites to me. That was me saving grace, really. And as I say, I came out of those there with top marks all the way through, and with, I think, a healthy third-class mark in me in history. So I was on the road for keeping in the Royal Tank Corps, as it was then, and not being dumped into the lesser mortals.
So at the end of the course, you could drive most lorries, presumably, and vehicles. And maintain
yes.
Most of the vehicles of the day.
Yes. It was said, I never found any example of this, but it was said that the course was open to civilians as well for a price of £500, which was an awful lot of money. I think that's why apparently the course was open for civilians to come in and take it. It was so thorough.
And you had your final tests and so forth, and as you say, you came out of them extremely well indeed. We'll come back to the vehicles as and when you meet them in the rest of your service. You said at the end of the X number of weeks, whatever it was, 22 weeks, you were offered 8 days leave.
That's right. I went on the way, eight days of fatigue.
And you stayed in the camp.
Which I enjoyed, actually. It was in the dining room. I was cleaning tables and all.
Why had you not gone on leave?
I didn't have the money. I didn't have the money to do so. These days, I was still naive. I was, still naive and not at all conversant with the ways of the world. I wasn't streetwise at all. These days, knowing what I did now, I would have took a leave and gone rough and had an enjoyable, whatever that means. You might look for me son, even the Boy Scouts or whatever. But anyway, no, I was beginning the 5 weeks, of course. I was now saying, well, hey, I've got a knuckle under. I have rules to obey, and obey them I must. And it wasn't the thing to do that sort of thing. So I carried on leave, well, fair enough. It was a holiday, well still away.
Did you get an increase in wage because of now being a qualified?
We're not qualified.
Yeah. Oh, we're not qualified yet. You're still on the way. Yeah.
I've got an awful shock for you when I come to the end of my 36 weeks or 9 months of training.
Before we leave it, very very briefly, it would be a long day. Was it the normal working hours of the army that you'd been used to?
You got up at 6 o'clock in the summer and 6:30 in the winter, and it was usually an hour and a half for breakfast, getting your accommodation okay. By the way, the iron discipline was still there on the drill square, but only there. It eased off in the back room. It eased off down the gymnasium. In fact, the gymnasium instructor, he said, right now, if you want to use the gymnasium, you come down, lads, and I'll be here, I'll help you all I can. And we did. Now, I was quite good at high jumping, and he taught me from doing the scissors to the Western Road, which I think put about, 9 inches on me, which was very, very good. Anyway, so it was easing off. I think put it another way is we'd been wound up on the first five, and now we've got the momentum to carry on at that level.
Were there any accidents during this course of training?
Yes, unfortunately, we did, of course, have our cross-country runs to do. And one of our squad dropped down and died. Only one of those, we all remember that. It was quite sad at the time. But for a day, we hadn't time.
Was there an inquiry?
Not that I know of, no. It was, it's not like today. I mean, you were, when you took the king shilling, as it were, it was more than a shilling, you were you were property of the government. And in fact, later on, I was put on charge for deliberately damaging government property. That was my charge, and you can't guess what I'd done. Because I had trouble with my tooth in the battalion, I told them that I said, before we go into the thinking army dentist, because there was no anaesthetic for drilling then, it was there, you just on the top of the head, and said, fool you, I'm having this bloody tooth out. So, come the weekend, I went into Andover and had a civilian dentist taken out. Of course, the next inspection, the tooth was missing. And that was the charge. I had deliberately damaged government property. I'm digressing.
As part of the training, we've mentioned that you worked on these vehicles and so forth. Were you also expected to keep the vehicles clean?
No, not in our training, no. Not at all. Later on, I can come to that as well, later on when we went to the battalion. Open your eye on one or two points there as well. So as I say, the lads came back after their 8 days leave, full of being well. They enjoyed themselves, anyway. And we came to the very first and first of only two lessons in route marching. And when the modern soldier hears what I've got to say here, the double up with laughter. What an easy time we had in those days. Talk about yomping, Sunday afternoon amble as far as we could better. Anyway, we had to march from Bobbingham Camp Base Depot to the Lulworth Town Gunnery School, a distance of about 5 to 6 miles. The dress was light marching order and best serge, so that's putties and what have you, plus your webbing equipment, but less pack, mess tin, which hung on the back, water bottle, haversack, and no personal arms. Of course, we have evolved in any case, but no personal arms. But that's like marching order. And that's how we marched. Talk about youth, I guess. And that's how we came back, by the way, after the 9 weeks there. But you know, if I might just digress for a moment, you'll appreciate the fact that a training squad, in the Royal Town Corps then, was in essence a microcosm of the entire Royal Town Corps in the making. Now, just let's see what yomping they did. So, when I'm talking about my squad, what I'm talking about is the entire Town Corps, of course, because we would be sent to the five British based battalions. The 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th. Four. Because the 1st had just gone out to Egypt. The 2nd battalion. In the beginning of the war, they found themselves in Burma. And because there was no bridges over the River Chinwin which would take the weight of what tanks they got left, they had to yomp from the River Chinwin to the Burmese Indian Order, the border. That's yomping. So you see, our training was okay. No, I can go through the whole lot and tell you that. But so
you're capable of doing it if you have to.
Capable of doing it. There's no argument about that. But that was our two. So we arrived at the lowest training.
What date would this be in your career?
Yes. The other night I was trying to work it out. It would be the end of January.
37?
36. 36. End of January 36. In other words, the coldest part of the winter. And over there in Lulworth, we did have army huts. There were smaller incidentally than the bombing huts. But the ablutions were outside. Talk about no hot water, no cold water, it was frozen solid. In fact, we were told to fill our mugs up at night, take them to the bathroom with us, and that's what we wash and shave in next morning, because that's the only water we had. Anyway, come to the Lulworth Gunnery School. When I was at Bobbington, we often used to see quite a number of medium tanks going around, you know. None of them had any turrets on. When we got to Lulworth Gunnery School, we found where the turrets were. such was the tactness of economic in those days, you know, they had to split things up like that. I never did see a medium tank with its turret on and go into my battalion. But anyway, we got there, and that's, as I say, that's where we found our turrets. And these turrets, by the way, were sort of like weapons, you know, but they were handling. Right, let's get into order with this gunnery school. When we went there, we were introduced to our living quarters, these huts, which only had one single stove, and that had to be put out at 10 o'clock each night, you know, in there. But also amongst the barrack room furniture, each barrack room had one Vickers .303 machine gun with the firing pin, but incidentally missing. That's the only thing. Because every single man was put through thoroughly trained in, first of all, machine guns. Now, the Vickers machine gun had a propensity for stoppages, i.e. you'd be firing away and it would stop. But what stopped it? You look at your the position of your loading handle, and that would tell you what stoppages was and what particular stoppage had stopped the gun and what the remedy was. There were four or five. Now, we were taught how to do those stoppages, i.e. in the classroom. He would put, we'd have to turn our heads away, he'd put the stoppage up, put a sheet over the handle so he couldn't, he'd come along and say, right, carry on firing, you'd be imitating firing, and then whip the gun stop and whip the sheet away. And that's the first thing you'd see, and you quickly remedy it, and stop what you've got on you for quickness. So, as I say, a jam round because it's been bruised or something like that, an insufficient charge in the round, or the fusee spring wasn't of the right tension, the flash cover dropped off the front of you know, all these sorts of things. And as I say, the position of that cocking handle gave you what it was, and immediately you looked at the you didn't have 10, so I said it's the number 4. It was there, it was a real situation, and you had to do it quickly, otherwise you can't find anything. Well,
were you taught also to strip it down and build it up?
Well, then, that of course was the first thing, stripping it down, building it up, and free. And of course, that was put on a stopwatch. But you've got, I think, 7 or 8 people in a class, gunnery class, and you've only got the one gun. So if you're going to teach, you know, you're going to sit around doing nothing most of the time. So these were taught how to do it, and you run through it and what have you. Then when you finish at night time, there wasn't so much bowl to do if you didn't go on parade or something like that, but your nights were taken up stripping down and building up this gun. And we used to have bets on who could do it quickest. You know, it's very, it's a sort of everything, you know, isn't it? But anyway, let's talk about these stoppages. Here's the sting in the tail. They had to be done blindfolded. Because when a tank turret is battened down for battle, there's no lights that there is today. No lights in the tank turret nowadays. So you had to do it by feel. Now, you know, that's quite something, isn't it? Now, and the other thing, this is where these tank turrets came in. Remember I was saying something about dexterity? Do the letter C with your left hand and the figure 8 with your right foot and what have you at the same time. A tank gunner, a 3-pounder gun, his his right hand was turning a vertically spindle handle. In other words, it is a horizontal plane he's turning it anti-clockwise and the turret would go anti-clockwise. Turn it clockwise and the turret would go clockwise. Now, whilst he was doing that, his left hand would be elevating or depressing the gun with a horizontal spindle on a vertical plane handle. So there's your two hands doing two different things at the same time. Now you see how it's coming in, and believe me, when you actually get on the range, and especially with traversing the turret, the tank can swing faster than you can traverse the turret. And so you're looking through your telescope, and you're turning the turret anti-clockwise, so everything in your telescope is passing from left to right, right? And suddenly it goes right to left because the tank is turning on. Mm-hmm. You say, oh, am I going the right way? And you start turning the right. Dexterity, you know, nimbleness of mind and physical. It was quite something. And by the way, fact, we tank people in the 1930s were the only troops in the world, and forget about the Navy and the Air Force, we were the only land forces in the world who fired at a moving target from a moving platform. We were the only people that was trained. What price you give me your German armored division, panzer divisions, eh? Anyway, more about that later on as well. So that's what these turrets were there for. We would spend our time. You know, there's no guns in them or what have you. They were for instruction, you see, doing this, and we would have bets on that in our spare time. A Saturday afternoon, somebody had a Saturday afternoon doing this, yes! So, really, the tank corps did have to have a little. Yes, so really, the tank corps did have to have people who knew the other side of the table, as it were.
So this period of time now, you're learning gunnery.
Yes.
And were these the guns of a range of tanks, or just the guns of?
There was only two types of. I'm now talking about early 1936. In the school, there were only two types of guns: the 3-pounder, quick firing semi-automatic, that was the main gun, and the Vickers .303 machine gun. It was to be developed later, but that'll come later. Mm-hmm. The 3-pounder was capable of firing an armored piercing shell and a high explosive shell. More about that later. We spent, I would say, out of the 9 weeks we were in Lowes, we would spend probably 7 weeks in the classroom learning, and I've told you.
Was this ballistics that you were learning in the classroom with?
No,
with
the how
the functioning of the
guns work. We were introduced to the recoil system of the big gun and what have you, and the runout, the hydraulic system. We were taught how to adjust it, what have you. We were taught, of course, the same as that, the 3-pounder, how to strip the beach bomb, drop down, and generally look after and maintain the armaments.
You weren't learning to fire them, in effect, were you?
Oh, yes.
It was pure maintenance.
Now, as I say, we didn't go onto the range until probably the last fortnight.
So these 9 weeks, you were literally learning how to repair and maintain.
maintain, plus a frequent visit to the next bit of the simulator business. I talked about the right one, didn't I? Now we come on to the second right one. Yes.